From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, a look at the issues facing national forests with a woman in charge of the eastern region. Later, Wes Moore talks about the diverging paths taken by him and another Baltimore native named Wes Moore.
These were two kids who were both searching for similar things at similar times in our life. We're both searching for a sense of belonging, a sense of involvement, a sense of positive role models. And fundamentally what happened was one kid got it and the other kid did not.
An etiquette coach wants to take the golden rule one step further. And advice for those who would use their bicycles to burn fat.
Just make it fun. Don't push yourself. Don't think that you can whip yourself into shape. Don't take this wonderful child's toy, even if it's several thousand dollars. Don't turn it into a torture device.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's great to have you with us today. The U.S. Forest Service manages tens of millions of acres of forest land across the country for the benefit of many stakeholders and for many purposes, commercial logging, recreation, and even wilderness preservation. The National Forest System is divided into nine regions. One of the largest and most geographically diverse is Region 9, which runs from the Missouri River to the Atlantic Ocean. The region is headquartered here in Milwaukee and overseen by the regional forester, a position just filled by Kathleen Atkinson. She joined us in the studio in May to give us an on-the-ground sense of what the forests face today. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you.
I want to start with the impact of the sequester on national forests. And as simply as this question, how are national forests being affected by it?
Well, right now, we are in the process of getting our budget for this year. So we'll know better in the coming weeks. What we're doing to prepare ourselves, what we have been doing, is looking for cost efficiencies. Obviously, we're always trying to use the taxpayers' dollars wisely, but we've been looking for ways that we can streamline some costs and save money to hopefully reduce any impacts from the sequestration.
There were some much publicized impacts in the national park system. We've heard about parks with reduced operating hours or reduced amenities and such. That has not been the case yet at this point for the National Forest System?
Not yet. We're, again, there may be some impacts with some reduced hours, but we're really looking to try to find some other ways to absorb those impacts.
Of course, one of the stakeholders involved in the national forests are timber companies and timber interests. Is the impact on the national forests of tight budget climates, is it going to put more pressure on the revenue generating side of the equation?
I don't think so. And I really am kind of also excited to see our shift in how we work with our wide range of publics. We're really, over the past couple years, have really been looking at a much more collaborative approach in working with the publics. And it's really exciting because that also kind of lends itself to developing more partnerships, which helps leverage our dollars also.
This is something that the Forest Service has been sensitive to in the past, is the criticism that it's managing the forests for the benefit of some stakeholders versus others.
Right. And again, I think by sort of approaching management on a more holistic basis, looking at a watershed versus just one resource area, it really allows us to draw in that wide range of public and get their thoughts and ideas on management.
We should point out that you are the regional forester. That means you are essentially overseeing Region 9 of the Forest Service, which is a pretty vast space. Describe what this region is and how – well, let's start there. I mean, Region 9 is based in Milwaukee. We do not have a national forest in Milwaukee, but where does it stretch?
It is a very large region. It goes from Minnesota to Maine to West Virginia to Missouri. Covers 20 states. That's 43% of the nation's population, 17 national forests, and one prairie.
So are there primary issues that face the region as a whole? I mean, are there commonalities within, you know, national forests in Missouri versus New Hampshire versus Minnesota?
I would say couple ones spring to mind. One is forest health and keeping our forests healthy, in the midst of a changing climate and preparing them for the future climate that might be slightly different than what we have right now. And also invasive species. We have a significant problem with invasive species, whether that's insects, plants, mussels in the Great Lakes. It's a wide range.
Well, in fact, let's stick with invasive species for a moment, because there is a lot of attention paid in this particular state to the emerald ash borer, and in places like Michigan as well. And I guess recently there was the news that the emerald ash borer has been found in even New Hampshire. This seems to be one of those issues that knows no borders. What is the Forest Service's role within the overall effort to either stem or control the spread of EAB?
One of the interesting things about forests in the eastern region is we do not have a solid ownership pattern, meaning within a proclaimed national forest boundary, it's not all federally owned land. Usually it's about half the land within the boundary is federally owned, and the other half is private. So we have to work closely with the private landholders, both to manage forests, to manage within the national forests, but also, like you say, it's really an all lands approach. So the Forest Service has several other branches, one which is state and private and one which is research, all of which have to work together to address issues such as these.
Are you feeling good about where that coordination is at this point? Obviously, the EAB has continued to spread at this stage.
Right. I feel good about how we're working with the private landowners and with the state forestry organizations. Issues like this are very difficult because they don't have a natural predator here, and so really we're in a mode of trying to contain.
There was the news out just recently that carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are at record high levels. You talked about the need to manage forests for future changes in climate. What does that mean? What is making a healthy forest today have to do with the climate that might exist 10 years from now?
Well, when you're talking about managing a forest, trees grow slowly, and it's a long-term investment. And so if you're thinking about maybe you're doing some reforestation in an area, you need to be thinking about the next 80 years. Will the climate be the same? Are species going to move on the landscape? Are plants and animals going to move? And so we have to be thinking ahead and not just sort of replicating what was there at the current time.
I know one of the issues out west is when you get into forest health actually involves forest restoration, taking down trees to improve the health of the forest. Is that an issue in the eastern region? Are there forests that are unhealthy because they have been allowed to essentially grow unabated for so long?
I think one of the unique challenges in the east is because we acquired the lands because they were degraded. And so we set about doing restoration many, many years ago. But what that means in many cases is the trees are all roughly the same age. And so a healthy forest would involve a lot of different ages of trees. And so that's something that we're looking at and considering as we do management.
Your background seems perfect for this role. You've worked in recreation, in timber management, as a district ranger, as a silviculturalist. Is there one area in forest work that you feel like you connect with the best?
Well, that's an interesting question. I have worked in a lot of geographic areas and with a lot of resource areas. And to me, that's one of the fun things about working for the Forest Service is I've gotten to live all over, meet all kinds of people, and do vastly different jobs. And I've enjoyed that immensely.
I mean, I imagine no one necessarily goes into forestry because they especially enjoy working with budgets.
Well, I don't
know
about that.
I'm not saying you don't enjoy working with budgets, but I'm asking you to think back when you first entered the field. What was it about the field that connected with you in the first place?
So I grew up on a small farm in southwestern Michigan, and I used to love to go out with my father, and he would graft black walnut trees and make some very bad maple syrup. And so I really enjoyed just being outside, and that's what prompted me to go into forestry. So for me, it was a love of the resources.
Before you came out to Region 9, you went to work every day in Washington, D.C. Now your office is in downtown Milwaukee. Both cities have their fair amount of trees, but obviously neither is in the midst of a national forest. If you are someone who lives in urban America, how do you think our national forest system should touch your life?
That is a wonderful question. And so we have a program called Urban Connections, where we have individuals in some major cities, Detroit, Boston. And it's really important that we make a connection to urban youth and urban people in general, to the land. And so that's a strong area of focus. And what we want to do is get people to really appreciate the national forests that they own and get to use.
So the idea is that connecting people to the land here makes them more interested, more invested in, more willing to go to the national forests beyond that?
We want to help people understand nature in general and the importance of the natural environment. And sure, we'd love to have them come out to the national forests. But if it also means that they become interested in small urban forests, that's wonderful too. We just want to connect people to nature.
We talked about how you originally got connected to nature. Even after all of these years doing it, what still gets you the most fired up about working in forestry?
When I get to go out to a natural environment, a national forest, and talk to people that are there and enjoying it, that just makes me feel so good. And it makes me feel very proud of what we're doing as the Forest Service.
Do you think there's an untold story about national forests that people don't appreciate?
I think so. Many people don't understand or know the difference between a national forest and a national park or a state forest. And I don't know that necessarily that distinction is important. Again, what is important is that they understand nature and that they appreciate it.
Not long ago, I chatted with the author of a book on the history of America's eastern forests. And one of the issues he was talking about that faces some, especially in the Northeast and in places like North Carolina, is rapid development in the areas surrounding national forests. Are those issues that the national forests themselves and the Forest Service can do something about, or is this another one of those cases where you really have to wait to see what happens outside and then deal with the after effects of, you know, a state's decision or a municipality's decision?
That's a difficult one, especially for the Eastern National Forest, because with our fragmented land ownership pattern, when people develop their private land, oftentimes that means they have a need for utilities that would cross national forest to get to their private land, driveways, roads. And all these things obviously have impacts on the environment. So it's really important for us to work with the local communities to try to minimize that. And, you know, because it's one thing if it's one house in the middle of surrounded by national forest. It's another thing if it's a highly developed subdivision.
Is there a single greatest challenge that you see as you look across the eastern region right now that the Forest Service has to deal with?
I think the greatest challenge I see is making that connection, again, with our population just increasingly urban, is making that connection and having people appreciate their national forest.
Well, I mean, I guess the other question I had for you is, you know, in years past, there has been this kind of push-pull between when it comes to wilderness management. I know in the Monongahela National Forest in West Virginia, wilderness is a huge part of the equation, as it is in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area wilderness. Where is wilderness at this stage of the game? Are there other similar situations in national forests in the East where wilderness might play a larger role?
Well, you know, you recently had a guest on that talked about once you label an area and, you know, as wilderness, that it attracts a lot more attention. And that's something we've seen in the Forest Service too, because we have a lot of areas which are fairly remote, have a lot of the characteristics, but are not necessarily labeled as wilderness. But right now, we have not seen a big push to do a lot of designation of additional areas.
Are there other aspects to what you do as the regional forester that you think people ought to know about?
again, I would just kind of go back to making the connection of people to the landscape. And we do a lot of work with youth and going into schools and talking to folks. And I know it used to be more of a Smokey Bear message about fire. But I'm really excited to see us really working with schools and with nonprofit groups to really reach out to young people and bring them out to the forest and bring them out to other forested landscapes and have them just understand and appreciate the beauty of nature.
You wouldn't say that Smokey Bear is outdated, though.
Oh, of course not.
Smokey Bear perhaps ought to have a sidekick who can talk about the other recreational aspects of the forest.
Well, that's true, but Smokey still has an important message, and children love him too.
Kathleen Atkinson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kathleen Atkinson is the regional forester for Region 9, or the eastern region of the U.S. Forest Service, which includes Wisconsin. Its western border runs from Minnesota south to Missouri, and on the eastern side, it goes from Maine to Maryland. Our interview first aired in May. Two Wes Moores, both from Baltimore, both with challenging childhoods. One becomes a Rhodes Scholar, the other a convicted murderer. The scholar seeks out the murderer, and what emerges is a powerful story about the choices we make and the importance of role models. We'll hear more in a moment on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Since the time you were very young, you've probably been told it. Our choices matter. Almost everything we do can have an impact on the rest of our life. Sometimes it's hard to see that lesson come into focus. But in the case of Wes Moore, that lesson is extremely visible. Moore faced significant challenges in his childhood growing up in Maryland, which we'll hear about shortly. So did another kid growing up nearby who also happened to be named Wes Moore. But their paths diverged, and the Wes Moore we'll hear from went on to write a book called The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates, about his own life and that of his namesake, who ended up in prison convicted of murder. We reached Wes Moore in March ahead of a visit to Milwaukee Area Technical College. Nice to speak with you.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you so much.
For people who maybe haven't heard your story or the full story, can you share it with us in a nutshell? How do you frame your story as, and I'll put it in air quotes, the other Wes Moore?
Well, I think the way I try to phrase it, it's a story that that even though the premise and the hook is about these two guys with the same name who go in very different directions, the way I really look at the story is it's about much more than just these two kids. Or about one neighborhood or about one race or one socioeconomic group, but it's about all of us. It's about the decisions that we make in our lives and the people we have in our lives who help us to make those decisions. And the way that this initial story first started off was literally about 12 years ago. I just received the Rhodes Scholarship, and I was getting ready to head off to England, and my local paper, which is the Baltimore Sun, was writing this article about this local kid who just got this scholarship. And they talked a little bit about my past and my childhood and how I had a lot of challenges coming up. But through the help and love of a lot of people, and a lot of people who believed in second chances, I picked a different aspect for my life. But at the same time, they were in the process of writing a whole series of articles about four guys who one day robbed a jewelry store and killed an off-duty police officer in this botched robbery attempt. And so as I started learning more about this crime and about this tragedy, the more I realized how much that one of the people that the police were looking for. That was eventually captured and tried and convicted and sentenced, that his name was also Wes Moore. And the more I learned about this crime and this tragedy, and the more I learned about the people who were responsible for it, the more I realized how much more Wes and I had in common than just our name. And it was that initial hook that really led to this larger exploration that not only did I learn more about him, but quite honestly, in the process, I learned more about myself.
Do you feel like, is it too strong a word to say that his story haunted you at some point?
No, I don't think that's too strong at all, because I think it did. In fact, there was a lot of people who quite honestly, looked and said, I don't know why you're still curious about this. Why do you want to get in touch with him? Why are you giving him your address? A whole collection of things that came into it. But I knew there were questions I wanted to ask, and I knew Wes was the only one that could answer them. So one day I just decided to write him a note, and eventually he wrote back, and eventually that one note turned into dozens of letters between us, and those dozens of letters turned into dozens of visits, and now I've known Wes for close to a decade.
The conclusion you draw in your book, and frankly it's the subtitle of your book as well, is that you and the other Wes Moore's lives could easily have been reversed. And that is a powerful message. How do you think, as you studied your own life and you study the other Wes Moore's life, how have you been able to understand your own resilience?
Well, I think, you know, my own resilience is one thing, but I think, you know, the resilience is premised on the fact that there were a lot of people who were willing to give me second chances, even though, when quite honestly, I didn't deserve it. There were a lot of people who were willing to believe in me in a way that I wasn't even yet prepared to believe in myself. And so, I'm just incredibly thankful for the amount of people that invested in me, that invested time and energy and resources into helping me out. And what I wanted people to understand is that, this is not a story of good Wes, bad Wes, or good mom, bad mom, or, one of us got sent away, the other one did not, or anything along those lines. Because the truth is, these were two kids who were both searching for similar things at similar times in our life. We're both searching for a sense of belonging, a sense of involvement, a sense of positive role models. And fundamentally what happened was one kid got it, and the other kid did not. And then the world now bears witness to the final results of either our larger attention or our larger apathy. So in no way do I stand here and say that, that I did great and it was because of everything that I did. I was very fortunate to have a lot of people who believed in me and helped me to understand the world is bigger and that I actually had a place in it.
This is really, the comparison is Wes Moore and this really important, powerful support system versus Wes Moore, who didn't have that stuff.
Yeah, and even though, and for example, I know, Wes's mother, she tried so hard she worked multiple jobs, she moved multiple times to get herself to better neighborhoods. I mean, she did so much. But I think, we also have to understand that when it comes to service and when it comes to helping out kids, that there has to be a two-generation approach to this. It cannot simply be about helping out the child or simply about helping out the parent. That there has to be a two-generation approach as the way we look at services and support. And when we do that, we're able to see a holistic response throughout the family that then, reverberates throughout generations. But we cannot simply think that there's going to be a one single solution to be able to address the challenges that so many people are facing, because for many families, the challenges are holistic. And the only way that you can address a holistic breakdown is a holistic buildup.
Do you think people are too eager to generalize from your story to how it should pertain to another story?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I really wanted to address in this, was the fact that I believe that both Wes and I are very easy to caricature. We're both very easy for people to come up with quick and glib, in many cases, incorrect assumptions as to who we are and to how we got there. One thing I did not want this story to be is just simply another, something that just plays into prejudices or stereotypes or anything along those lines. But I wanted people to understand the human nature behind it. And this in no way is to condone activities or condone actions. I have never once condoned the things that Wes did to get him incarcerated, and nor will I ever condone that. But I also do know this, is that, right now sitting in prison is a person who is smart, gregarious, he's interesting, he's interested, and he's made some horrible decisions in his life. But I think about, had his decisions been different, the kind of contribution that he potentially could be making to society is real. And that's what I wanted people to understand, is that we cannot be too quick to dismiss. We cannot be too quick to isolate, because we have no idea the kind of gems, the underlying gems that are sitting within the people who we are isolating.
How do you think your own understanding of these two stories affects who you are as a parent?
And that's a great question, because I think so much of my parenting, has come from, and for all of us, so much of our parenting comes from our experiences. And I think this has been an incredibly important experience in my growth, my development. I think I'm a different person than when I was a decade ago when I first met Wes. I'm more introspective. I'm more thoughtful. I'm more thankful. And I think all those things play into the dynamics that I see within my own family and the things that I hope to instill within my own daughter. I mean, when people ask me, they say, You know, what is it you want your daughter to be? And you know, what, as if like there's a job or a college that I want her to go to. I said, that's not, you know, there is no answer for that. I want her to be happy. But the thing that I really want her to be more than anything, I want her to be empathetic. I want her to understand that the world is not all about her, and that she has a very distinct role and responsibility in helping to make this world a better place. And if she takes that seriously, then I have no choice but to be incredibly proud of her.
Where do you hope this storyline takes you next?
Well, I the thing that I know I want to be more involved in, again, there's no specific thing that I'm looking for, or job or responsibility or anything like that. The thing I really want to be is I want to be useful. I want to make sure that people can, you know, within my story and between these stories, see so much of themselves, see where they are, and the type of impact that they can have if they simply choose to have that impact. The thing I also want to make sure I make a real dent on is this focus on education. I'm a firm believer that education at its core is who we are as a nation, and our national strength and our national vibrance will be determined by the amount of human capital that we can produce in this country every single day. If we're successful at that, everything else becomes just details and we're fine. And if we're not successful at that, then everything else becomes just details and we're not fine. So these are the things that I want people to understand. Is as we're having these much larger conversations about who we are and what we're doing, we cannot forget about the imperativeness of this larger educational conversation.
Wes Moore, it's a terrific story, and I'm so grateful you shared it with us.
Well, it's absolutely my pleasure, and again, I thank you for the time, and I just thank you for your attention to these matters. Again, there's, you know, everything else that we can debate and we can argue over, we can do that, but if we get this right, then we're on a path to just a remarkable future in our communities and in our country.
Wes Moore is the author of the best-selling book, The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates. He's a veteran of the war in Afghanistan, a former White House fellow, and founder of a Baltimore organization that works with children in the criminal justice system. He spoke with us ahead of a visit to MATC in March. Wisconsin fares poorly in a survey of politeness. What does that say about the state of etiquette here? Some thoughts from an expert when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. Call it a Midwest nice malfunction. A study this spring ranked Wisconsin as the least courteous state in the country. The Marchex Institute analyzed the use of words like please and thank you in phone conversations between consumers and businesses. It found Wisconsinites lacking. The Institute is the research arm of the Marchex company, which seeks to maximize the return on cellular advertising. To understand Wisconsin's poor ranking, Lake Effect's Amy Kiley turned to etiquette consultant Marjorie Sinclair. She's author of A Year of Good Manners, and her home state's discourteous designation surprised her.
I thought you said the first. I thought we would be the most courteous in whatever way it was being ranked or studied. So I was quite surprised. I thought we were very nice people.
Yeah, so what happened to Midwest nice in Wisconsin? Was it our politics or the weather?
It might have been that day, but I looked up this study that you told me about. It involved customer service in large corporations. So I think they were measuring people who were really angry to start with. And sometimes it's easier to be a little vehement with anonymity. And so you don't see or know the person you're talking to, and it just happens then.
What is the difference between consumer calls to a business versus interacting with people at a business face-to-face or talking with people who are friends or family?
Oh, it's much easier to be anonymous. Yes, you see a lot of things get said on the internet that way because there's that shield of anonymity. But when you're looking at someone face-to-face or within the family, it's much more difficult to be mean because they can be mean back to you. You know, in customer service things, the representatives have the right, called a green light, to hang up on you if you're really abusive. Sometimes it's called a verbal assault, and they don't have to put up with it either. Also, my point is it's counterproductive. If you have a really big problem and you need help on this, it's just going to be better if you have that person working with you. I think I would probably say, you are the third person I've been talking to, and it's been 45 minutes. And I really hope that you can help me now because I'm frustrated, and I really hope you can help me. And you can see how my voice changes during that, too.
versus becoming antagonistic in some way.
Yes, I mean, I've said this all before to you. Well, it wasn't to you, it was somebody else. But still, you need to get to the right person. So you want those people on your side.
That makes sense. This study also tracked words like please and thank you, mm-hmm. which seem like givens that our parents taught us. But in conversations, do we forget to use those?
I think some gentle reminders are involved here. When I do children's programs, I ask, how many times a day do you have to say please or thank you? It's not as if there's a magic number, like six. So you said please six times before noon today, so you're done for the day? No, it's every time you ask for something, and then thank you every time you get something.
This study also tracked swearing. Luckily, Wisconsin was not in the sailor category, as it put it.
Yes.
But can you talk about people swearing in conversations? How often does that happen and what prompts it?
It seems to be becoming more casual. It isn't just in fury and for great alarm. It's just becoming casual. And I think that's part of the coarsening of America. I'm sorry to see that.
In your work as an etiquette expert, what kinds of courtesy pitfalls do you commonly encounter?
Well, people just not using the golden rule or the platinum rule. Now, I'm sure you know about the golden rule, about treating other people the way you want to be treated. And I've also done these programs in Beijing for Chinese salespeople who are coming to the U.S. There I learned that the golden rule in Chinese is a double negative. They say, don't treat other people the way you don't want them to treat you, which amounts to the same thing. But the one I want to add is the platinum rule, because gold is a rare, precious metal, and platinum is even higher and more scarce and more expensive. So the platinum rule is that you should treat other people the way they want to be treated. Not everyone wants to be treated the same way. So how do you know? They give hints. You have to pay attention.
So in terms of courtesy pitfalls, then, do people treat others as they would treat themselves, or are they not aware of the needs of the other person?
I think they're simply not aware. And there is a difference between thoughtless and rude. Thoughtless is accidental. Thoughtless is being in a hurry. Thoughtless is saying something that you shouldn't have. And, of course, also we get into the point about different manners in private or in public. I say there should be no difference, because what we do in private tells who we really are. And if you use these words in private, and just in regular casual conversation, they will tend to slip out at the most inopportune moments.
What is the difference between manners and etiquette?
Etiquette refers to all of the rules governing behavior. And going back thousands of years in the time of the Egyptians, but also around the time of the kings of France, Louis XIV, XV, and XVI, they started writing this down. So all of the rules of behavior would include, for instance, if you went to court at Versailles, one of the rules was your shadow was not allowed to touch the shadow of the king. And you think, how are you supposed to know things like this? Well, on the back of the invitation was written the most important rules of behavior. So you had a chance to read that in advance, then present your invitation as identification when you arrived at Versailles. And they knew you had been properly invited and you were not crashing the party. But manners, on the other hand, is an English word, and that refers to your personal behavior. So etiquette is sort of the how-to. And between the two, manners is more important. Manners are more important than etiquette.
Etiquette makes me think often of weddings and mm-hmm. knowing not to wear white like the bride and such. How are we supposed to know these etiquette rules, and how important are they in those kinds of social interactions?
Sometimes people say to me, who makes up these rules anyway? Well, right. If you have ever had an opinion about somebody else's good manners or bad manners, you are part of the consensus. And this rule about guests not wearing white to the wedding got started because there were just a lot of brides who were annoyed that someone else was wearing the color that was supposed to, they thought, special for them that day.
Is it really important when going to a social function like that to study the rules and follow the rules?
I think it's important to talk with the hosts. There are some brides that would not mind if you wore dark denim jeans to the wedding. And there are other brides that would mind. So you have to sort of have to know your hostess, what are they expecting? This is, again, treating other people the way they want to be treated. You might think there's nothing wrong with this, but if it's the host or hostess, their opinions count. And when you are the host and hostess, your opinions count then too.
Can you talk us through some professional interactions? How can we behave according to proper etiquette in those?
I think by being on your best behavior all of the time, not having two separate sets of manners like some that you use for guests and others, you know, just for people at home, you know who deserves your best manners would be the people you live with. I use this question sometimes. Does a socially graceful person have both company and everyday manners? And it's a trick question. which I hated when I was in school because I thought they were so sneaky. But teachers like them because it gets you to think in different categories. So having two separate sets of manners, the answer is, it sounds like a good idea. You should know both. And the answer is no. You should only have one set of manners. Those are your best manners. Those are the ones you use every day, even with the family, like even them. But, of course, they are the ones who deserve your best manners. So having one set of manners for all the time, then you're not going to get caught with these bad words slipping out at these inopportune moments, like live television.
Are you saying that we maintain the same manners with both groups? But is the etiquette the same? Do I treat my boss like I treat my mom?
With kindness and respect and patience, in that case, yes. So rather than getting into specific illustrations, I tend to like professional principles that it can be applied to many other situations. But basically, how we want to be treated is with kindness and respect, and as a 7-year-old told me recently, with patience. And I thought that was a good one to add.
Especially for a 7-year-old.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Who apparently thought he wasn't getting some patience from other people.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And what are some other basic rules to leave listeners with so that they can live by better etiquette and have better manners?
Treat other people the way you want to be treated, and then figure out also how they want to be treated. Recently, I was at a restaurant, and the waitress was late teens, maybe late college, early 20s, and she called me sweetie. And as you can imagine, Miss Sinclair was not amused at that. She was not trying to be rude. I think she was trying to be friendly. So I didn't want to embarrass her. I said nothing to her, but I did find the manager, because what she should have done was use ma'am. Sir or ma'am, when you don't know the person's name, very useful. And then you're treating them with respect. That shows that you expect to be treated with more respect also. We teach other people how to treat us.
That anecdote brings up another question, too, that in different cultures or subcultures, for instance, in the South, that might be acceptable. But here in Wisconsin, it's less so. How do you navigate those social waters?
Well, part of being elegant is being appropriate. And you do. You just look around. I know that some families in the South, the children address their parents as sir and ma'am, which we don't do here. People hold the silverware different in different parts of the country, in different parts of the world. You know about American style and European style, also called continental style. So if I were at a table and we were finishing eating and everyone had put the knife and fork down and, let's say, a table of six, five people had the tines of the fork curving downward, that's what I would do. If five of them had the tines of the fork curving upward, that's what I would do.
Anything else you'd like to add?
I think in five words, it sums it all up by saying good manners are good business. They're cost-effective, they're free, and they make everyone look good. Also, keep on writing your thank you notes.
Marjorie Sinclair, thank you for being on Lake Effect.
You're welcome. I appreciate the invitation.
Marjorie Sinclair is a local etiquette consultant and the author of A Year of Good Manners. She spoke with Lake Effect's Amy Kiley in May about Wisconsin's designation as the least courteous state in the country. One last break, and then the author of a guide that deconstructs some myths about bicycling. Grant Peterson says, just ride after a break on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. As the Tour de France enters its second week, the first step has been taken in a Milwaukee program that makes bike sharing easier. Midwest Bike Share has launched its first kiosk located on the lakefront in Discovery World with plans to expand much further by next year. The hope is that people will be drawn to the ease of hopping on a bike and scooting across town, whether to get to a meeting or to get some exercise. It's part of a larger movement to return simplicity to the enterprise of bike riding, a reaction against the commodification of bicycling, in which spandex and sports drinks are as important as just having fun. Grant Peterson is on a mission to change attitudes. His recent book is called Just Ride, a radically practical guide to riding your bike, and he joined us in the studio on a trip through Milwaukee. Welcome to the show.
It's nice to be here, Mitch. Thanks for having me.
What is the mentality out there about bicycling that you were seeking to counter with this book?
That we should look to professional racers and even amateur racers for guidance in anything having to do with riding a bicycle, and that could be the clothing that you wear, the food that you eat, certainly the shoes that you wear, I guess that's part of clothing, and the way that you ride a bike and, you know, what is required, and even the attitude that you have when you ride a bike.
What was the tipping point when cycling went from just being an activity that people did in their leisure time to it coming with this extra layer of attitude or clothing? Or at what point do you think things changed for cycling in this country?
I think I think I know when it changed. I think it was when Greg LeMond started winning the top races in Europe. And I'm a huge Greg LeMond fan. And, you know, he's a hero. He's a great guy, all that kind of stuff. But before that, bicycle racing was not big in the United States. Touring had already had its day. And here was this, you know, guy, Greg LeMond, you know, winning. He won three tours to France. And manufacturers capitalized on that. And that's when the hoopla began.
And you have been a bicycle racer yourself in the past.
Yeah, I raced for about 6.5 years. I was never all that good at it. But,
but you have, instead of making that your mentality, you have crafted the concept of the unracer.
I've been more of a racer than an unracer. You know, when I quit racing, I continued riding like a racer for about 22 years. I mean, all my rides were timed and hard and long. And I didn't want to give up, you know, what I thought was my edge that I'd gained from racing. It seemed like I'd graduated from being a tourist to a racer, and I didn't want to throw in the towel. And so I rode, I'd say, the wrong way for a long time.
Well, and so when did the epiphany for you happen? When did you say, wait a minute, this is silly?
You know, there wasn't an aha moment. There was just I started going on a few rides without a firm connection to the pedal, and I started going on more sort of casual rides, but non-racing rides, just rides on trails in the hills, you know, when you camp out and stuff. And when you do that, all that racing garb is ridiculous. And you also notice, if you do it enough, that it doesn't make any difference. It really doesn't make any difference. So the way I'm dressed now, I'm ready to ride a bike.
Well, and so why do you think a guide like this was needed? Why is it necessarily a bad thing for people to take their cues from the bicycle racers, aside from the, you know, not wanting everybody to go out there and, you know, be doping?
Actually, yes, I do think it's a bad thing. I think it's a bad thing because it gets people moving in the wrong direction for bicycles. Now, whenever you wear a uniform, I mean, you can be a cop or a prostitute or whatever. If you have a uniform, you sort of take on the swagger that goes along with that uniform. And when you dress like a pro, suddenly at that point you don't want old ladies to pass you on the road. You see people up ahead of you on the road as carrots that you've got to catch. And it sort of puts the pressure on you to ride according to the uniform.
Well, and so let's talk about some of the specific issues you address. And a very basic one, and you've alluded to this, is what cyclists wear. You know, you see people out on group rides or even by themselves, and they're wearing road racing attire. It's got bright colors. It's got ads all over it. Why do you contend this is not what they need to or maybe even ought to wear when they're out on a ride?
Let me say that, you know, however anybody gets their kicks, you know, is fine with me. You know, there's – it's sort of ritual, I guess, if you're in a club to dress like the club. Same members of the, you know, the Mohicans all had mohawks, things like that. It's like the team effect. There's camaraderie and all that in there too. And I've got no problem with that. But what I do have a problem with and what I'm trying to fight, I guess, I don't know if that's the right word, but it's the idea that, oh, some guy goes into a bike shop. He wants to start riding a little bit longer, and he comes out, you know, equipped with all the funny stuff, you know, the shoes, the spandex, the Lycra, the padded shorts, everything about it. And it sends the message that this is what is required to be anything other than a casual cyclist. And when I say casual cyclist, I think casual cyclists. I think they're just as high on the ladder as anybody else, but you do not need to dress like that. You don't need to dress like that. And that doesn't mean that every garment in your wardrobe is great for cycling, but you know, most casual clothing is. Most casual clothing is.
Well, right. So let me ask that. If you're the guy that goes into the cycle shop and decides he wants to he or she wants to get into cycling, what are some of the more practical things that that they can be wearing? You know, if not their business suit, you know, what makes a good cycling wardrobe?
For the last probably 10 years, 99%+ of my rides, all of my miles, I've worn Teva sandals. They're just sandals. I use platform pedals, just double-sided like BMX pedals. I wear light nylon or cotton shorts, nothing with a big seam in them. I wear whatever socks I happen to have on. T-shirts, long sleeve shirts, they can be loose. You don't need a tight shirt. And that's about it.
You kind of get into the idea, the notion that people who say that they want to have fabric that breathes, that there's really no such thing.
I don't think rainwear really breathes. I think, you know, like a light cotton shirt, that'll breathe. Cotton wool, just any, you know, the clothes that you have on now. It looks like you've got a cotton T-shirt on underneath a long sleeve plaid, nice shirt, by the way, button down cotton shirt. And that is perfectly good. And this idea that cotton is going to get wet and it's going to give you hypothermia or you'll get the chills because it won't dry out fast. You know, what kind of ride are we talking about? Are we talking about a cold weather ride of 5 or 6 hours? Then wear wool, wear some synthetic, whatever, dry fast clothing, wicking, stinky fabric that you want. But, you know, how many rides are like that? And is that even a healthy kind of ride? And I guess that would be another topic. But certainly, I think, you know, most people on a ride an hour or two, you can wear whatever you got going.
Well, and the other really touchy subject you get into is the wisdom of wearing a helmet. And this is something that we're led to believe is a given, that helmets equal safety. Why is that not necessarily the case?
It's not necessarily the case, I think, for two reasons. The first reason is that the helmets are not as protective as you would like them to be. I mean, bicycle helmet manufacturers cannot put all that much protection into 7 or 8 ounces. One time there was 5-ounce helmet. You just can't do that. It's styrofoam and some sort of a hard shell to distribute the load. You can't put that much protection into a helmet that cyclists are going to buy. And yet, the helmet is a safety item. It's for protection. So you put it on, you think you're protected. Whenever you wear a protective garment of any kind, you tend to engage in behaviors that you would not do without it. That is the whole point. And if the protection is complete, if it's thorough, complete protection, hey, everything is good. But in the case of the bicycle helmet, when it's not as protective and you ride a little bit more risky because of it, then it's not so good. It's sort of like a bulletproof vest with a bunch of gaps in it or something like that.
Well, and I think you're right that the ideal thing to do is to wear a helmet and then forget you have it on.
That's right. Anytime I'm about to hit my head, I'd rather have a helmet on. And I'm not against helmets. I'm not against helmets. I am against, I guess, the idea that they are as protective as you would like them to be. Wear the helmet, pretend you don't have it on, whatever.
Let's talk about the bikes themselves, and you get into some really technical issues later on in this. But there's a very basic message that you write very early on in this book, and that is most bikes have way more gears than people need. Why would you contend that really, I think you write that 8 gears are sufficient for what most people are doing?
You know, I don't think the surplus of gears is one of the top evils in bikedom or anything like that. But it's easy enough to make the case that 8 gears is enough. I'll count them out right now. You need a really, really high gear for pedaling downhills, a regular high gear for pedaling with a tailwind, medium high gear, medium low gear, super low gear, and ultra, ultra, supremely low gear, and that is 8. And I would, you know, I challenge anybody to come up with how are you going to add more than that, you know. But it's another influence that came from racers. Racers used to ride 10-speed bikes, mathematically 10-speed, meaning two rings in the front and five cogs in the back. And now they're mathematically 30 speeds and they're going to even more. And so when Joe Blow goes out to buy a bike, he looks at what the racers are riding, and bike shops tend to do that too. And then, well, they're the pros. They must know the best. So I'm going to get the same kind of thing. And then you end up with all kinds of gears. Now, for a racer, there are benefits to having smaller increments between gears. If you aren't racing, fewer benefits. Just pedal a little bit faster, pedal a little bit harder, bridge the gap, 8's enough. My bike has 27, but that's just the way it came.
So what do you think is at stake here? Why is it important to break down some of these myths? Do you think, are there people out there that might be bicyclists, if not for them?
If you are enjoying riding racerly, you know, if you enjoy the costume, the effort and all that, then I think it's just fine. But, you know, a lot of people, like a typical adult cyclist, gets into bikes again, you know, and is, I'll just say it's a guy, but it's with women too. But in his 30s or something, maybe he's gaining a little bit of weight. He doesn't want to go swimming. He doesn't want to swim. You know, it's not convenient to swim, and it's a whole other world. You can't swim to work. Swimming is out. Running is out for a lot of people. A lot of people are too heavy to run. It's miserable to run. I mean, for a lot of people it is. And so bikes are natural. You know, they get into a style of riding that I think is – It doesn't give them what they want. You know, people want to lose weight. People want to be healthy and lose weight. And as you age, you know, you don't want to be the fat old guy. And so they get into a racer style of riding because they see that racers are skinny and they think that they're going to get skinny too. It doesn't work that way. You cannot ride off weight if the only change is exercise. You're just building up a bigger appetite and eating more food. And then the kinds of foods that you're encouraged to eat, carbohydrates, just make you fat anyway. So it doesn't work that way, and I know that.
So in the end, it's really about changing your lifestyle and not necessarily conforming to any one image of what a bicyclist should be.
I think that a bicycle should be fun, and I think it should be transportation, recreation. It can be a good way to see the country if you want to go and do that by bicycle. But just make it fun. Don't push yourself. Don't think that you can whip yourself into shape. Don't take this wonderful child's toy, even if it's several thousand dollars, it's still a toy. If you are not a pro, it's a toy. Don't turn it into a torture device. Don't turn it into a piece of fitness equipment. Go to the gym for that. I mean, that's a dreadful way to ride a bike.
Grant Peterson, thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Mitch.
Grant Peterson's book is called Just Ride, A Radically Practical Guide to Riding Your Bike, published by Workman. He lives in California, where he is the founder and owner of Rivendell Bicycle Works, which makes steel bike frames. Our interview first aired in June. That's all for Monday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. It was so great to have you with us today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 o'clock for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. This is NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.